Stay tuned for Juno Afternoon. We'll talk with artist Clarissa Resolve about Weavers Across the Waters Chilkat Weaving Project. Forrest Wagner will be here to talk about UAS Outdoor Studies. James Bibb and Peggy Ann McConaughey will be here to highlight the Juno Gastineau Rotary Spring Bulk Sale. And we'll find out about Thursday's World Day of Prayer. That, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more, live at 3 on KTOO. Stay tuned.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Large amounts of fentanyl tested positive in heroin recently seized in southwest Alaska after three people overdosed and one person died in the village of Quinahook. KYUK's Charles Enoch reports.
Fentanyl is a synthetic drug 10 to 20 times stronger than heroin. Charles Foster is a scientific director with the state crime lab.
Fentanyl is a synthetic opiate that's quite a bit stronger than morphine and heroin. So heroin is about 4 to 5 times more potent than morphine, whereas fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more potent.
Foster says fentanyl is a powerful painkiller commonly taken through skin patches for chronic pain management. Alaska State Troopers spokesperson Megan Peters says fentanyl adds even more danger to the opiate drug epidemic sweeping rural Alaska.
A heroin user, if they inject themselves with their quote-unquote usual amount of heroin, or what they think is what they normally take, and it has fentanyl in it when it's unbeknownst to them, they really are at a greater risk of overdosing than if they were just consuming heroin.
Troopers say, well, this isn't the first time fentanyl has been found mixed with heroin in the state. It's the first time it's been found in such large amounts. Last year, the state crime lab found it in a sample from Juneau. Foster added that fentanyl is still relatively rare in Alaska. Troopers are still investigating that incident in Quinahook and would not release any further details. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Leaders of the Yakama Nation are headed to North Dakota to show their support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in its fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline. A caravan left the reservation in Washington State on Sunday. Jody Gotti, chairman of the Yakama Nation, says he can relate to pipeline opposition. He says the Yakama Nation has fought oil and coal transportation by rail in the Northwest and says it's imperative to stand with Standing Rock.
It relates to us, and if there's a precedent set in a negative way against the Standing Rock Sioux and the other nations that are standing against the various fossil fuel superhighway transports that are being advocated at this time, it will impact. And so we need to go and support our brother and sister nations and make a stand as best as we can for our territories, our Inchuana and our other ceded and treaty territories throughout the Yakama Nation. And in doing so, hopefully we'll find a stronger path for ourselves all.
Yakama Nation Tribal Council member Frank Mesplee.
We're going to be there, meet with their head chief and et cetera, and do prayer service, and hopefully with something that comes on in the long run. If we don't protect this one, then it affects our Columbia River, our land, our air, our water.
The Standing Rock Sioux Tribe has received letters of support and resolutions from tribes across the country in its opposition to the 4-state Dakota Access Pipeline. Those who are not making the trip in person to Standing Rock are showing their support by holding demonstrations in their communities, including one which was held over the weekend in Seattle. A number of Arizona tribes are joining a conservation group and Congressman Raul Grijalva in an effort to protect the Great Bend of the Gila. The area in Maricopa and Yuma counties includes archaeological remains, historic trails, and rock art. Legislation to protect the area was introduced this summer. A press conference is scheduled to take place in Phoenix, Arizona today to discuss protection of the site. A University of South Dakota professor is being remembered for his work in Indian education, which dates back to the late 1960s. Wayne Evans, who was born on the Rosebud Reservation, died Friday. He was involved in the South Dakota Indian Education Association, Upward Bound, and a number of other educational programs. And he was known as a spiritual leader and drum keeper. Evans was 78 years old. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation, and by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C.
Support by the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions in Albuquerque. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And welcome to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Lori Scandling in the studio with our producer, Jeff Brown. I'd like to take a moment to thank Jeff for producing every show that I've had the privilege of being a host on. I very much appreciate it. He makes it easy because I get to walk in and be a curious person with so many amazing guests here in Juneau. Well, welcome to today's program. A quick look at the weather. It will be mostly cloudy with scattered rain showers through tomorrow, improving, if you can call it that, to just cloudy tomorrow night. I'm pleased to have with me today our first guest, Clarissa Rizal. She is a born and bred Juneau person and a well-known Chilkat weaver who is making her mark in a number of ways that have gained attention recently, although this skill has been something she's practiced for quite some time. Welcome, Clarissa. In reading in the Capital City Weekly about the Weavers Across the Water Project and the, is that 40-plus, what you might call crochet-sized squares for the project related to the Huna tribe returning to the Glacier Bay area, I began to wonder how you first got into Chilkat weaving. And the article mentions you were apprenticed to Jenny Flinault when she was 95 years old, and that once she passed away, it was difficult for you to get back into weaving. What isn't clear to me is how a young woman in Juneau, Alaska, perhaps prior to a cultural resurgence, which we very fortunately are experiencing in this region and perhaps other regions of our state, how is it you were drawn to Chilkat weaving, and how did you become an apprentice?
I was first drawn to weaving through Jenny by way of Haines, because Haines is where my heart is. There's a specific area of Haines at the mouth of the Chilkat River called Paradise Cove, and that's where the river meets the ocean. And I used to have land there. That place, for whatever reason of all places I've ever been, it just makes my heart sore. And the only other place that I've been to since and has been the area that's called Georgia O'Keeffe Country, which is the northern part of New Mexico. And I drive through there on occasion, at least once a year, because I drive from Colorado down to New Mexico, Santa Fe, and Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I go through that country, same feel. I love that country, and it's total opposite than what we experience, you know, at Paradise Cove in Haines. And so I heard about this weaving workshop that Jenny Flinault was doing, and I was invited to it, all expenses paid. And I thought, well, doggone, 2 weeks, get away from Juneau, get away from the kids for a while. Well, how do I weigh that out? And, of course, Bill, my husband then, he just kind of goes, yeah, why don't you just go ahead and go? All expenses paid. Go. Enjoy yourself. And that's what I did. And I really wasn't into Chilkat weaving. I didn't want to. I wasn't interested in that. I was interested in having an all expenses paid trip to spend 2 weeks in Haines. So it was for that reason that I was led into Chilkat weaving by way of Jenny, who, when I saw her fingering technique, which was so fast and accurate and smooth, and then just hanging out with her for 2 weeks, I was totally inspired. That woman was, to me, she was just, she was something else.
When was that, Clarissa? How long ago was that?
March 1985, February, March 1985.
So 30 plus years ago.
Yeah.
In that time, how have you grown as a weaver? It looks difficult.
Yeah. I've been weaving since then, and I've been teaching since 89. Let me tell you, I remember Jenny Fanat saying during a dinner, she was introduced as a master weaver, right? And so she gets up to talk, right? And in her speech, she says, master weaver, what's that? And we're all sitting there like, well, isn't that what you are? And she's like, how am I a master weaver? I'm still learning. And right there, that gave us some perspective and question. And at that time, there were only a couple of people who knew how to weave, and they weren't as prolific as her. One was Cheryl Samuels. Another one was Maria Ackerman Miller. And, you know, we didn't really have anyone to consult with, right, as new students. And there was just a handful of us new students out there really committed to doing this. And I tell you what, I've been weaving for what? I was first introduced to it in 1983 and swore I would never weave again, okay? It was too hard, too difficult. My weaving was as heavy as a rock because it was so doggone tight. You couldn't even tell it was woven. I just says, okay, I'm not going to ever do this again. Anyway, when all of us weavers came together like that, I was on to it. And I tell you, 30 years of weaving, it's only been in the last 2 years that there was this breakthrough, like I knew what I was doing. One day I just knew what I was doing. There I am. I'm sitting at the weaving loom finishing up this robe for the Portland Art Museum. This was 2 years ago. And I knew exactly what I was doing. I knew how to do it. I didn't have to think about it. It was like, boom, 30 years. Jenny. And I still have to, okay, figure things out, but it comes naturally now. Jenny had been weaving 83 years of her 95 years. And I tell you what, it's a lifelong learning experience. And like for me, just 2 years ago, I feel like that breakthrough has helped set me free, and there's this level of freedom, but at the same time, I know that I'm still learning. There's all these things that I'm learning how to do, or do it differently, or figure this one out, or what if I do it like this? There's only three techniques in Chilkat weaving, okay? The twining, the braiding, and the interlock. However, how you shape your shapes and how you do all your braiding that follows those shapes, it's endless. It's really interesting.
You call it a spiritual experience. Is this because it's related to the sense of place at Paradise Cove, or is there something additionally transcendent?
It's transcendent. And it has, sure, it has to do with that place, but it has to do mainly with the place within yourself. And it is a spiritual experience for me. I have done all kinds of art forms. I have done painting. I have done sculptures. I have carved wood. That, in fact, that was my first medium that I worked in was wood with Peter Bibb at the high school back in 1972. And when I went to visit him, I showed him my brochure. I showed him this little booklet of all these robes that I had sewn or woven, right? And I showed it to him, and he looks at it, and I says, and right here are the credits, and I give credit to you. I says, I just want to let you know that I'm not going to get this book published probably before you pass, but I want you to know how that particular class opened up the doors for me to my world of my ancestral beings and all the people who've come before me and all those will come after me, and what that did for me, and how he said to me in his southern accent, "Young girl," he looks at my carving. He says, "Man, you're pretty good at that. If you ever want to do this for a living, you'd be up there." Yep, yep. And I didn't even know what doing it for a living meant back then.
Talk about the project Weavers Across the Water that has received recent attention because of the dedication of the project itself, which is a robe of many contributors in last week's re-arrival, shall we say, of the Huna tribe at the mouth of Glacier Bay. Describe the project and how it came about.
It was February 26th, just this year. I was in a conversation with my friend Susie Williams. I was in, Tulsa, Oklahoma. She was in Kloak, Alaska. We were talking about how we were into our various projects, and I told her, "It's all about weaving for me. All I see is Chilkat, Chilkat this, Chilkat that. Oh, this is Chilkat, that's Chilkat." And she says, "Well, all I see is weaving and crochet." She says, "Well, hey, have you ever done a crocheted 5x5, or, you know, those crocheted squares, and you make a granny square?" And I said, "A granny square blanket, you sew them all up together." And I go, yeah, I did one of those for my mother years ago, back in the late 60s, early 70s. She goes, "Yeah, well, I want to be doing that. I want to get back into doing crocheted granny squares." And I'm like, "Wait a minute." And all of a sudden, from a distance, and as it got closer to me, I could see this thing moving in front of me. And it was this Chilkat raven's tail robe that was put together like granny squares, right? Each individually woven by weavers from up and down the coast of the Northwest, right? And I said, "Susie, shut up. Susie, quiet. Wait, I've got to tell you this. I see this thing coming." And she's like, What? And I tell her. I says, it's this robe, right? And she just laughs. She goes, "Wow, Clarissa, what a great idea." And she says, "You know what? And when the robe is done, it could be used for the One Canoe Society any time that they do a canoe gathering." And I was like, "Yeah, like canoe gatherings up and down the coast." And so we laughed, and I said, "Susie, I'm going to do this." And she goes, yeah, you go right ahead now, girl. And I said, "No, I'm serious." And, and when we got off the phone, I wrote down all the notes. I expounded on it. I just went crazy with it. And I ran with it. And it bugged me for a whole month and a half until tax day, the 15th. And I did my taxes. I was just like, whatever, taxes. And I shoved it all aside, and I just had to do this drawing, had to launch it on Facebook and email and my website, and just invited every weaver I knew, any and all, no matter what background, no matter where they came from. I wanted this thing to happen. So I invited, it was open invitation to whomever was native from whatever tribe, or if it was non-native person, that they had to be married or with a native man or adopted into the clan or whatever. So that's the way I just sent it out there.
I have to say, reading the story in this week's Capital City Weekly, as much as I love radio, radio cannot do justice to the beauty that is captured in the pictures of this beautiful robe made of these squares. I could talk with you all afternoon, Clarissa, and maybe we'll have that opportunity at some time. I'm talking with Clarissa Rizal. She is, I almost hesitate to say master weaver because she's already shaking her head, a wonderful weaver with many years' experience and still learning the Chilkat weaving style. And your website, Clarissa, why don't you say that so folks could take a look or maybe join you on Facebook?
Our Facebook page is called Weavers Across the Waters, and that pages where people are welcome to post, their weavings. We have a lot of videos lately of the robe being danced, videos and photos, the robe being danced by Wayne Price, who is the first of who knows how many years, the first carver honored for the dugout canoes in Glacier Bay, because he was commissioned by Huna Indian Association to do these two 40-foot dugouts. Wayne, as far as I know, is like one of maybe four carvers in the Northwest Coast who knows how to carve the traditional dugout seafaring canoes. And so we honored him there at the Glacier Bay event, and it was to his surprise. It was quite emotional for him, and then, of course, emotional for us, because it was emotional for him to have that honor.
You can learn more about Clarissa's work and that of other Chilkat-style weavers at Weavers Across the Waters. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for joining us today,
Clarissa. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday, the 29th of August, 2016. It's the birthday of the man who said, "Love is the master key that opens the gates of happiness, of hatred, of jealousy, and most easily of all, the gate of fear. How terrible is the one fact of beauty." That was Oliver Wendell Holmes, the poet and the physician, born in Cambridge in 1809, a friend of Emerson's, of Longfellow's, other Boston intellectuals, who helped to found the Atlantic Monthly magazine in 1857, and it was Holmes who came up with the name, famous for his poem Old Ironsides, and also for his collection of essays, The Poet at the Breakfast Table, in which he wrote, "We are all tattooed in our cradles with the beliefs of our tribe. The record may seem superficial, but it is indelible." It was his son who was the Supreme Court Justice. This was Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who said, "Insanity is often the logic of an accurate mind overtasked. Good mental machinery ought to break its own wheels and levers if anything is thrust among them suddenly, which tends to stop them or reverse their motion. A weak mind does not accumulate force enough to hurt itself. Stupidity often saves a man from going mad." It's the birthday of the man who said, "The actions of men are the best interpreters of their thought," John Locke, the philosopher, born in Somerset, England, 1632, who believed that all knowledge is derived from the senses, and that we can know about morality with the same precision that we know about math, because we create our ideas. His essay Concerning Human Understanding, published in 1688, a big hit all across Europe. It's the birthday of Karen Hess, born Baltimore, 1952, author of books for young adults. She married, she had two children, worked her way through a whole array of jobs, waitress and nanny and typesetter, proofreader, substitute teacher, book reviewer. Kept writing, published her first book in 1991, Wish on a Unicorn, and then in 1998, Out of the Dust, the story of a girl living through the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. It won the Newbery Medal and the Scott Odell Award in 1998. Here's a poem by Michelle Boisseau entitled Take Your Kids to the Funeral. Let them stretch out on the cool pews and listen to the valves of the church pump with coughs and foot scrapes. Let them discover the pleasing weirdness of pressing your belly against the seat edge and swinging your legs. Let them roll the bulletin into a telescope, stare a hole into their hands and heal it. The liturgy won't hold them, but the furtive dabbing versus sudden bursts of tears will foster a curiosity about powers and exponents. Rock, paper, scissors, luck leaps in your fingers. Bring your kids to the funeral and let us smell their heads. A poem by Michel Boisseau, Take Your Kids to the Funeral, from Among the Gorgons, published by University of Tampa Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Lumosity. Brain training with over 50 challenging games, from scientists working with university researchers to push cognitive research forward. Learn more at lumosity.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with insurance for cars, home, boat, motorcycles, RVs, and commercial vehicles, at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Lori Scandling and Jeff Brown in the studio. Today, our guest is Forrest Wagner to talk about us, about the UAS Outdoor Studies Program with us. Glad to have you here.
Thanks, Lori.
Forrest, when I first heard your name, I'm like, I know that name, as probably lots of people do, having read about the incident near Haines in April, where you were leading an outdoor studies class on a mountain hike, it sounds like, perhaps in the snow, and were surprised by a bear that then mauled you. Can you talk briefly about that experience? I think for most people listening, if we spend time in Alaska, it's one of those fears that joins us when we're on the trail or in the woods. Talk a little bit about that and what you have taken away from that. It sounded like almost a near-death experience.
Oh, it certainly was, and this happened on April 18th, about 1:30 in the afternoon. I was descending with a group of 11 college students. I was the 12th member of the party. We were climbing and skiing on Mount Emmerich, which is the beautiful peak behind Haines, and I was in front of the group putting in a ski track and then returning up the ski track with my skins, and was surprised by believed to be a sow grizzly, and had about 15 seconds to react. She and I rolled down a high slope angle avalanche gully for probably about 2.5 minutes, and she grabbed my leg and ripped me off my skis. I hit her with my mountaineering ski pole, it's a whippet, and as we were rolling, I tried to punch her in the face. That wasn't very effective. And, you know, a take-home message is you're not going to win wrestling a brown bear. Most of the contact I had was with the bear involved her holding onto me with her mouth, biting my left side, and we were rolling down this steep hill. And at some point, I stayed conscious through the entire experience. I realized that it was a brown bear and that I needed to play dead. My parasympathetic reaction had been to fight. It was, you know, not a lot of time, and the fight or flight thing was definitely I was fighting. And then I covered my airway in my face, and that energy changed, and she went to, you know, to face me basically, and. I had just protected myself, and so she cracked my helmet, and I had a black eye. But thankfully, at that point, we rolled off a small cliff, and she landed next to me, and I think that changed her focus. And I was laying in an L position and looking at her, and she stood up and looked at me, and I was playing dead. And she walked to the edge of this drainage, which was filled with isothermal snow, and looked at me again, and then walked away. And thankfully, we were well prepared with communication. We had a sat phone and various other communication devices. We had cell service and air ground radio, and were able to execute a very timely rescue in a pretty challenging bit of terrain. It was heavy timber and had been snowing significantly the day before, and then the day after, because I was watching the weather while in the hospital in Anchorage, it rained a lot. So we were lucky that I think that the incident commander on the Haines side was a medical professional in Haines, but a Temsco helicopter came from Skagway, and I was picked off in about an hour and a half from the event and medevac to Anchorage, and was in the hospital 18 days and then an outpatient in Anchorage up until the end of July. So pretty serious situation. As to your question, I'm very excited to be back in Juneau teaching outdoor studies and obviously very lucky to be around. And I think outdoor studies is a distinctive program at UAS, and that outdoor education is very important for enriching our sort of very human experience on a fragile planet. And you know, in 1900, there was 1 billion people on the planet, and now there's 7 billion. And part of what we teach in this program, and really throughout humanities programming and social science and all of really arts and sciences at UAS, is this kind of interdisciplinary disciplinary approach to person, place, and society, and how we might fit in this kind of late capitalist world where there are a lot of people, and what a privilege it is to live here in this place with wildlands that are preserved, and that thankfully there still are brown bears in the mountains. And a lot of the reason I'm here today is that I was with the right people who, yes, they were my students, but this final mountaineering class was kind of represents the level of training that our programs offer.
What are some of the programs that are offered? Let's talk about those, because I was surprised to know there are 3 degrees that students can earn through UAS that have to do with outdoor studies.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we have a certificate in outdoor skills and leadership, which is a 1-year program. It's a great fit for folks who already have a 4-year degree, a bachelor level degree, or are midway through a program at the 4-year level. And it's an intensive 10-month program beginning now and ending mid-May with an expedition. So we were talking about the Emmerich incident. Following the Emmerich incident, the capstone experience went up on the ice fields, a 2-week climbing and skiing trip. And the way the program works, we have a core group of academic classes in the fall and spring, and then students choose from skills classes that relate to season in the fall and spring, and they culminate in this multi-week capstone experience. And we also have emphasis areas in a Bachelor of Liberal Arts, and the degree title is Outdoor and Adventure Studies, and then we have an emphasis area in the Bachelor of Arts Geography and Environmental Studies degree. And those programs involve a second round of expeditioning, the capstone experience, for the junior or senior level student who's in the 4-year program. And actually this past year, in December of 15 and January of 16, we took a group of 6 outdoor studies 4-year students to Japan, and we're ski mountaineering on Honshu Island, Honshu in Hakuba, which was a pretty unique experience for all of us. And in the past, we've gone to Ecuador. We've taken students up on Denali on Mount McKinley. And so that capstone experience is really an opportunity for folks in our program to actually get the multi-week, because we start now at this time of year with the day outing, the intensive day outing. It goes to a multi-day outing. Semester wraps up. By the time we get to mountaineering in the spring, in April, we've got a 5-day outing, and then finally we go on this capstone. It's the multi-week outing. So we begin incrementally with the idea that experience is really amazing teaching tool.
It's what matters. So classes start today. Is there still time and room for students who would be interested in the outdoor studies? How can they hook up with it if they want to?
Yeah, thanks. So we're pleased to currently offer courses this fall semester in rock climbing, sea kayaking, backpacking, backcountry navigation and travel, and wilderness first responder, and also academic courses in outdoor leadership and environmental philosophy. The semester does begin today, but our courses are spread throughout the fall semester. So seats are still open, and most of the fall classes have minimal prerequisites. The probably the best way to get information is to visit the online schedule, www.uas.alaska.edu/schedule/fall.html, subject ODS. And thinking ahead, for those snow-minded, we have a very ski and ski mountaineering savvy community, Outdoor Studies is offering a professional avalanche level 1 in the spring semester per the American Avalanche, the AAA standard, February 2nd through 12th, and a level avalanche level 2 course with dates TBA, but probably late March. In addition, in the spring, we have winter and spring-related classes that build on classes we've offered in the fall, including ice climbing, glacier travel, crevasse rescue, winter backpacking, mountaineering, and then follow-up academic courses in outdoor leadership and environmental literature. And that spring schedule will be available for public review November 1st. And we are also coordinating the Banff Film Festival this year. The Outdoor Studies program is taking that over, and that's tentatively scheduled for February 15th at 7 p.m. in Centennial Hall. So we're really excited about that. And then I just wanted to make a quick plug, too, for humanities offerings. We have school does start today, but we do have space in a couple of our general education requirements, COM and English 111. And then we have some really unique upper division classes. Professor Richard Simpson's teaching an English 418 documentary film theory and practice. And Saul Neely teaches English and philosophy and is teaching an English 419 Toni Morrison class. So there's a lot going on at UAS right now. And
excitement awaits.
Yeah.
For the brain and the mind and the spirit. We're talking with Forrest Wagner about the Outdoor Studies program at UAS. I have one last question. We just have a moment, but can you briefly say maybe how your view of the world has changed since you survived this amazing interaction with one of the most powerful forces in nature?
Yeah, I think Well, I'm very thankful to be here in Juneau and to be alive, but I think the chance occurrences that allowed me to survive the incident with the bear are the kind of thing that make me appreciate positivity and what a unique opportunity being alive really is, and also how privileged I am to sit here and talk to you about outdoor education and to live in a town like this. And, I think the amazing support from this community and from friends throughout Alaska and around the country was something that I never would have anticipated. And one reason to continue doing outdoor studies is because it is really about these small societies of people that learn to work together in a collaborative way, and it's a lovely thing, and it's a privilege, but also a pleasure to be part of. So this is this is the start of the semester. This is my 11th year doing this, but as time passes, I become more aware of the value of what we're doing with the liberal arts model and with outdoor studies in particular.
Thank you for sharing it with us. It's our pleasure, Forrest.
Oh, thanks.
This is Bird Note. It's the tail end of summer, and the Wilson's warblers had a busy few months. In May, courtship and nesting reached full swing. The tiny yellow birds made their homes amidst dense thickets in the humid and boreal coastal forests of northern North America. By early August, those forests were alive with flashes of yellow. Despite the attentions of predators and the vagaries of weather, many adult pairs have raised their four young, which flit and flicker amidst the undergrowth. Young male warblers, fledged in June or July, have been learning their father's songs all summer. Next spring, they will sing these songs too. By early September, perhaps after one last afternoon dip in a local puddle, Wilson's warblers will begin their migratory trek south. flying after dark to avoid predators, feeding in cover during the day. These tiny birds are bound for Belize, where many will find a winter home in a coffee plantation. So, if you're a coffee drinker and you choose to buy shade-grown coffee, you're helping to preserve the wintering grounds of this bird and many others. Thank you. Learn more at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. My guests in the studio are Peggy Ann McConaughey and James Bibb, who are from the Juno Gassner Rotary. Full disclosure, it is a club to which I belong as well. And it's great to have you here in the studio to talk about the centerpiece fundraiser for this club. It occurs to me that, as I felt a little over 5 years ago when I became a Rotarian, I really didn't know what Rotary was. Why don't, Peggy Ann, you're one of the early founders of the Juno Gassner Rotary. It was one of the first to admit women. Can you talk about what is the mission and the essence of Rotary? I know we have more than a million members around the world, but what is Rotary and what is the heart of it?
The heart of it is the people. It is about a group of people from all sorts of areas of business in the world who get together to do something for other people. And by virtue of the fact they come from different backgrounds, from different areas, we're able to accomplish amazing things, not only in Juneau, where we live, but also throughout our district, which is 501, which is Alaska and the Yukon, and then throughout the world. It's an amazing thing to belong to, and something that I, as one of the original charter members, didn't really understand until I joined, as far as what it actually does. And I'm so proud of all the things we contribute to, all the things we do together. It's not like any other organization I belong to. It's very different.
Service above self is not just a motto. It's a reality. I know that worldwide, one of the goals is nothing less than peace, but more immediately, the eradication of polio.
Absolutely.
Talk a little bit, Peggy Ann, about some of the local projects with which the public might be familiar or would like to know about that our club does. Or James, either one
James,
of you.
James, why don't you do? You've got the list.
Yeah, I mean, this gets to the point, actually, our fundraisers with the bulbs this year kind of go directly to those efforts. And if you're the Day of the Lake, you're probably familiar with that. And during the summertime, we sponsor a youth exchange, which is international exchange. Monthly dinners at the Glory Hole, things like that. Pioneer Home, we support the Pioneer Home, going out and throwing a nice Christmas party for them out there.
And buy the Christmas tree for them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wonderful.
I know that the club has also in the past supported the Zach Gordon Youth Center. Completed a new kitchen last year, if I recall.
Right, with our help, and we also help out with the
Arboretum.
Right. And we're building something there right now. So there's a lot of different projects throughout the community that we are involved in that people probably aren't quite sure how it got there, but we've been behind it. And the playground.
Yeah, the Riverbend School, elementary school, was a new playground addition this last year.
We also
and
Dock that.
Bay.
Dock Bay this year. Mm-hmm. So
people might not know that Rotarians were behind that. We should clarify for the public that there are three Rotary clubs in Juneau and have been for a long time. Each of them has their own fundraising. Talk a little bit about what the bulb sale is, James.
Well, the bulb sale is something that's been going for 15 years. This is our 15th year. And it is, like you mentioned, it is our major fundraiser. So if you haven't been approached by a Rotarian the last few weeks, you're going to come across somewhere else. Well, you're hearing about it now. And each club has a major fundraiser which helps them with these ongoing community projects.
Our fundraiser is the Rotary Bulbs is one of those, though, that I personally think is probably one of the best type of fundraisers, because it gives people the opportunity to be able to buy absolutely gorgeous bulbs by going to rotarybulbs.com and being able to purchase them for their own gardens.
Yeah.
Or it gives them the possibility of making a donation to help beautify different areas in our community. And, James, we've got many places where we will plant donated bulbs, correct?
Yeah. Last year was one that was really exciting, is the Yak Bay Roundabout. And we had a chance to work with the University of Alaska Southeast and to put in a group of bulbs out there, which kind of highlighted. And if you're like me, these last two springs have been absolutely wonderful. So by the time you're anticipating a great summer, these bulbs show up and sort of introduce our great, looking forward to the great summer frame of mind. And there's a roundabout across the bridge. And if you went downtown next to the Prospector before the city planting comes up, our bulbs come in early.
I should mention, it's not just the spring bulbs, which are luscious, and there are, I know, probably 15 to 20 different packages you can choose, but I just had lilies come out this last week.
Me too.
So it's really a spring and summer type of burst of color. So the information is at rotarybulbs.com. Mm-hmm. When's the last drop-dead minute you can order? Because I know there's a distribution event on Saturday, October 1st, which is typically at the AELNP garage. So by when do people need to order?
Well, the discussion of that in terms, you can order them up to the last day. I mean, what we would like to see is a few days prior so we can get the orders filled. We have to spend time just put them all in certain bags for people. But if you do not get to those orders in time, there is the garage sale on October 1st.
But you probably want to point out that if people see bulbs on rotarybulbs.com that they like, they better order early because we don't want to run out of the bulb that they want.
And some of those packages are super popular.
And they go quickly. Yes.
And some of the individual ones. We kind of reformatted how the bulbs are going this year. There's two basic packages. Then we have the a la carte. And some of the a la carte items, thanks to the master gardeners that happen to be members of our club, as you know, and then worked with James to try to put the packages together, really took the time to get some things that maybe we haven't had in our bulb packages the past 15 years. There's some amazing anemones. There's some amazing different tulip combinations. And when they put these other a la carte items, they organize them by color, which makes it fantastic. You take a look at maybe colors you want to add. And then I will point out, because this is what I always tease my husband about, is I don't have to worry about trying to grab my husband to dig a ditch to be able to plant the bulbs. Mm-hmm. One of the best things in the world is power planters.
Yep.
And it's $40 for an hour,
$40,
right?
I've hired power planters.
I do every single time.
I'm not there to do it myself. And they get the job done, and the money is to the club and its service projects. So I'm talking with Peggy Ann McConaughey and James Bibb about the Juno Gastineau Rotary Bulb Sale. It will be happening through the month of September. You can also hire power planters to come and plant if you yourself are donating them to a site, or maybe you're not physically capable of actually getting them in the ground in October. If you miss out on the sale, which you can do your shopping online at rotarybulbs.com, there is what we call the garage sale at the AELNP garage, and you can come and shop and pick stuff up.
And that's October 1st.
October 1st. I think 10 to 2
right.
is the time, right? Is there anything else the public should know about this sale?
Well, the one thing we pointed out is if you do not have a yard to plant bulbs, and there's always opportunity to consider a community donation. And those
school,
go to the schools, the roundabouts.
The bridge, daycare center.
Or a gift for a neighbor, something like that.
Well, thank you for your work.
Thank you, Laurie.
Have become a Rotary devotee knowing the good work that we do locally and around the world. So my bias is evident. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Have you heard the story behind the artwork in the foyer of the Walter Sobolev Building? Come into the Clan House this first Friday, September 2nd, to listen to an audio play of Allah, the Strongman, depicted in the house front by Chimshin artists David A. and David R. Boxley. Then register to win your own piece of Boxley art in the Sea Alaska Heritage Store. Free admission from 4:30 to 8 p.m. includes access to the gallery and artist demonstrations by Della Cheney and Rene Cole. This message brought to you by the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute and the Sea Alaska Heritage Store.
Walk the tightrope of goodness and hold on.
The Juno Arts and Humanities Council, in partnership with KTOO, is thrilled to bring Grammy-nominated musician Madis Yahu to Juno on September 23rd.
One day.
Expect an intimate, supercharged performance that blends reggae, beatboxing, hip-hop, singer-songwriting, and a whole lot of soul. Tickets at the Jack and Hearthside Books. Madis Yahu in Juno, September 23rd.
And welcome back to our final segment today on a Juno afternoon. Our guests are Kay McCarthy of the Shambhala Center here in Juno and George Partlow, who is with the Northern Light United Church. They, however, are representing an organization called Alaska Interfaith Power and Light, and they are here to talk about a specific event on Thursday. Welcome. So share what the event is on Thursday and what is bringing people together to celebrate the Day of Prayer or Day of Faith.
Well, this is the World Day of Prayer for the Care of Creation, which was called for by Pope Francis and the Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew. There's been a group that loosely coming together over the past year or so since the Pope's encyclical came out, Laudato Si, which was about the care for our common home, the care for the earth. And we're particularly interested in not just climate change, but the ecological crisis in general, and what the spiritual dimension of that is. So the Pope and the Ecumenical Patriarch have called for this day of prayer as an interfaith event. And on Thursday night at Northern Light United Church, we're going to have this day of prayer event at 7 p.m., and there will be people from many different faith communities throughout Juno taking part in it.
George, what is the spiritual, then, nature of the ecological situation, shall we say, of the earth? How does that translate?
Well, we can talk about it from many different faith perspectives. As a Protestant myself, I'm looking at it as a question of stewardship, that we quote Psalm 24, the earth is the Lord's and everything that is in it. We didn't create this world that we live in, and we're called to be stewards of it and take care of it. And our experience that we look around us and we see that we're not taking very good care of it. And the ways in which we're not taking good care of it are in particular impacting the most vulnerable and marginalized people in the world. About a quarter of the world's population, for example, live on seacoasts. Many of them are very, very poor, and they're the ones who are going to be affected immediately and drastically by the rise in sea levels as glaciers melt. We're already seeing here in the polar areas that climate change is impacting people much faster than elsewhere, and villages in the Arctic are having to relocate because of seacoast erosion, and that's just one example of people that are not really the ones who are causing the problem so much, but are the ones who are being the most impacted by it. And as people of faith, we look at this as a question of compassion, that we're called to care for the least and the most vulnerable and the marginalized, to make Roman Catholics talk about this as the preferential option for the poor. So this is a spiritual question and a moral question and not just a technical or a scientific one.
Thank you for making that connection. Kay, what is the Shambhala Center? And talk a little bit about that center's involvement in the Alaska Interfaith Power and Light.
Well, the Shambhala Center is an organization that's associated with Shambhala International. It's a Buddhist organization, and we have been in Juneau for many years, since the mid-90s when the Shambhala Center was founded. here, but it's associated with Shambhala International, which is a international Buddhist organization. And our teacher, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, came to the United States in the 70s and founded his first center in Barnett, Vermont, Karma Choling, and then he moved to the Naropa Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and he founded the Naropa Institute, which is a university now, a Buddhist university. So it's a large organization internationally, and our organization here does a lot of different kinds of things. We have meditation options for people to meditate at the center, to receive meditation instruction, to do various different kinds of educational programs that are associated with Shambhala.
And what is the Buddhist take on what George has just discussed in terms of the spiritual connection to the physical world and our responsibility for that?
Well, it's very compatible, or it's very much the same, because Buddhists, one of the first principles of Buddhism is do no harm. And the principle of doing no harm means literally doing no harm to everything, because Buddhists, the interconnectedness of all things, of all beings, and all aspects of life, both animate and inanimate, is part of the Buddhist theology, or if you could call it that. So Buddhists really believe that everything's interconnected, and we too have many concerns about poverty, about people who are going to be most affected by climate change, are people who live in places in the world that, they're not highly developed or highly technologically able to really manage the kinds of effects of climate change. Drought, fires. I mean, India, the fact that water is literally in trouble all over our planet is a major issue.
Thank you, Kay. We're talking with George Partlow of the Northern Light United Church and Kay McCarthy of the Shambhala Center about this coming Thursday's World Day of Prayer for the Care of Creation. If you would care to participate, there will be an event at 7 p.m. at Northern Light Church, which is downtown, as part of the Alaska Interfaith Power and Light attention to this special day. You can take part. 7 p.m. on Thursday. George, is there contact for more information on this?
They could call me.
Okay.
My cell number is 928-581-8146, or they can look up Northern Light United Church online and phone the church.
Thank you.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programs.